Governor Scott Walker says he's going to wait on implementing the Affordable Care Act in Wisconsin pending the outcome of the November elections. We are going to talk with Wisconsin's Attorney General, J.B. Van Hollen, about that approach and also get his reaction to the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that upheld the constitutionality of the national health care law. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 7:37 on this Tuesday, July 3rd. We will also welcome your questions for Attorney General Van Hollen at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let me welcome in J.B. Van Hollen, the Attorney General of Wisconsin. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
My first question is it hot enough for you?
I can take the heat. The humidity is what's getting me.
Yeah, it's going to be excessive heat warning, by the way, for today for southern and western Wisconsin, actually through 10 o'clock on Friday night. So stay cool. Well, speaking of hot, this decision has elicited a lot of reaction. Governor Walker says he's not going to start implementing the Affordable Care Act in Wisconsin, setting up these exchanges until after the November elections, hoping that the November elections will mean the possibility of repeal of this law. What's your reaction to the governor's approach?
Well, I think it's a prudent approach from a policy and fiscal perspective. The reality is that the day after the decision came out, or the day the decision came out, was no different, really, than the day before, because it was standing law until such time as it had been ruled unconstitutional, which it was not. So the law had in it some pretty liberal time frames, the ability to have considerable time to roll out health care exchanges and things along those lines. And the governor and his staff had already been waiting to implement them until after the decision because they had the wiggle room to do so. And I think it's a wise move to continue to wait within those windows now as well, because in the event that the law is repealed, it would be a shame if we spent a lot of taxpayer resources and time and money implementing something that we may just end up having to undo. So I find it to be a fairly prudent move, and there'll be plenty of time after the elections, if it needs to be implemented, to implement it.
Yeah. Well, do you think that this law should be repealed?
I do. I still stand by the opinion that it should have been ruled unconstitutional. The reality is that the ruling was definitely plowing new ground. And I understand that Chief Justice Roberts indicated that it's the court's job to find a law to be constitutional if at all possible. By the same token, you have to rely upon legislative intent. And when the President of the United States had repeatedly said in public that it was not a tax, and when the State Department of Justice had argued in multiple court levels that it wasn't a tax, for the court to find it to be a tax seems a bit odd to me. The two grounds that we had sued over, the state of Wisconsin and several other states, that the Medicaid expansion was an unconstitutional abuse of the spending clause, and that the individual mandate was a constitutional abuse of the Commerce Clause, were both found to have merit. In both cases, the Supreme Court found that those cases were unconstitutional overreaches. So, to me, it is quite an expansion of governmental powers. That is disturbing to somebody who represents the state of Wisconsin, because whenever the federal government gains more power, the state of Wisconsin loses power. But the reality is it is law, and it's going to stay that way. There is no higher court than the United States Supreme Court, and we need to honor that decision.
But you are also saying that the Supreme Court ruling is a victory for states' rights. How so?
Well, it's a victory on a couple of fronts and a loss on one. The one is the expansion of the taxing power, and I think every scholar would agree, or constitutional scholar would agree, that this is definitely an expansion of the taxing power beyond which has existed in the past. However, it is a great limit on the Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause has never had a significant limit put on it, and it is a means by which the government at the federal level has grown over the years. And it's even argued in the Supreme Court briefs, decision by most parties, that had The Commerce Clause been permitted to be used to force an individual to purchase something, then the federal government really would have had unlimited power to control our lives, which takes away powers of state and local governments and individuals to control their own lives. So for local control, that was a big victory, even though the case was a loss as far as overturning the Affordable Health Care Act goes. And as far as the Medicaid program as well, it has been long argued by the states that the federal government is reaching the point of coercion by saying that, you know, we're gonna do something harmful to you if you don't do what we tell you to do. Well, we have two governments, state governments and federal governments, for very good reasons. And if one gets to play big brother and tell the other one what to do all the time, then we might as well just have one government. And this is the first time that the court actually said, nope, the federal government has crossed the lines into coercion, and they cannot do what they did under the Medicaid scenario of this act. So those are two very big victories for states' rights, for local control, and for our balance of power.
Help me understand what the Supreme Court said that limits the Commerce Clause. I'm not sure I have that clear.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, under the Commerce Clause, the federal government has the ability to regulate interstate commerce, and the cases have always ruled that what that meant is they could limit or regulate a number of things, including the channels of interstate commerce and activity in interstate commerce. Our argument to the court was what they're trying to regulate in commerce now by mandating individuals buy health care was mandating or regulating inactivity. And if you can regulate activity and inactivity, what can't you regulate? And that's basically what they agreed with. They said, you're right, they can regulate activity, but they can't regulate inactivity. And that's exactly what they were trying to do here, and that the President and Congress were wrong and could not use that power. But they found under the taxing power that there was a justification for what they were doing.
So the individual mandate was not constitutional under the Commerce Clause, but the majority said it was constitutional under the taxing powers of the federal government.
Exactly.
Yeah. And what is it? What is your reaction to Justice Roberts, presumably or at least reportedly, changing his mind on this particular case?
Well, you know, first of all, I don't accept that's necessarily what happened. I don't know where that report came from. I know the Supreme Court tends to be pretty tight-lipped, so unless I had some pretty good evidence, I'm a little skeptical that that occurred. If it did, however, I don't think it's unusual in our court. The reason why they deliberate and the reason why they deliberate in private is because they have opportunity to come along what they believe is better information and better arguments and change their opinion from what it had been before they received that information. So I don't begrudge the Chief Justice for that. I don't begrudge him for his decision. I think it's, if you read it, it's a well-reasoned decision. It's not one with which I agree, but he writes a good opinion.
The Beloit newspaper ran an editorial the other day saying that Governor Walker should respect the ruling of the U.S. Supreme Court, even though the Beloit newspaper editorial board says we don't really necessarily agree with the Affordable Care Act either. They think what he is doing is bordering on nullification, which is, ignoring a court ruling, hoping, your reaction to that. Is this null? Are we trying to nullify the U.S. Supreme Court ruling?
Not at all. And we're not alone in Wisconsin as being a state that's not proceeding with further implementation until the November elections. You know, the bottom line is he is not ignoring or avoiding or snubbing his nose at this law. He is doing everything the law is requiring him to do. When the law gives you until April 15th to pay your taxes, most people wait till April 15th, and they utilize that money to their benefit. They don't pay their taxes a year early or 6 months early or most even a month early because it's not the prudent thing to do. And that's a lot of what Wisconsin is doing, waiting to do what we have to do until we absolutely have to, because unlike the tax analogy, here we may end up come April 15th not even to have to pay that tax. Why pay it in advance if there's a possibility we may not have to?
Our guest is J.B. Van Hollen, the Attorney General of Wisconsin. We're talking with him about the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that upheld the Affordable Care Act, and we're talking about what that means for Wisconsin. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page if you have a question or a view on this for Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen. Let's check the weather forecast for today. A good chance of rain in the north this morning. It's going to be hot with an excessive heat warning for parts of southern and western Wisconsin. High temperatures between 85 and 102 degrees. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, 12 minutes before 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, July 3rd. Coming up after 8, it's On Your Money. We'll welcome in certified financial planner Kevin McKinley for this week's edition of On Your Money. Kevin will have some advice on long-term care insurance, new information on retirement plans, and answers to your personal finance questions, as always. Right now, we are welcoming your questions for J.B. Van Hollen, the Attorney General of Wisconsin, talking about the Supreme Court ruling and the Affordable Care Act. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our first caller is Joyce in Sun Prairie. Hello, Joyce.
Hello. George Bush already instituted the penalty provision with the Medicare Part D Act. In order to sign up for it, if you delayed your signing up, if you didn't sign up when it became available to you, you would be charged 1% per month for every month you delayed it. And that charge would last for as long as you were in the program. To me, it seems like the same kind of thing.
Attorney General Van Hollen.
Sure. Thanks, Joyce. That's a good question. It's an area that that a lot of people have confused, and I can certainly understand that. The thing that you're talking about is almost exactly the grounds upon which the Supreme Court upheld this law, and that is that it was a tax. And I think that had the President of the United States and Congress come out and said, you know what, we're going to raise your taxes and we're going to implement a national socialized health care program, there wouldn't have been a lawsuit, because we have long agreed, I think, as states, that they do have pretty broad powers to tax, especially if they categorize the tax the same way. And it gets a little complicated, but it has to do with direct taxes and per capita taxes. And the federal government has always had certain powers to tax, but limited powers to tax as well. The case here, however, is they very clearly, within the law and within the arguments and the president's statement, said this was not a tax. What they said was that this was a regulation and a penalty. We argue that they didn't have the power to make this a regulation and a penalty, and that's what Medicaid and Medicare are. They are taxes, and very explicitly stated as such.
Joyce, thanks for the call. Anne in Campbellsport, I don't know if that answered your question.
I'm not sure it did. I keep hearing this referred to as a tax, and it gives the impression that we're all going to have to pay this. And my understanding is that the only people who will have to pay this are those that refuse to purchase health insurance. And if they do, this is a very minimal tax. I think it can't even exceed $700 a year, which is quite a bargain. So I just have a problem with this as a blanket tax on everyone when it really isn't.
All right.
Well, you're correct in that interpretation. I have not argued, and I don't think many have argued, but I haven't watched what a lot of people have said in interpretation of this law. It is not a blanket tax on everyone, but it is a tax just the same. Part of the reason why most of us, or many of us, believe that this is a tax that was invented out of whole cloth, that is something that even exceeded the scope of what Chief Justice Roberts and others could permit to occur, is just because of that. It is a limited tax on limited individuals, which most people, including Congress in this case, defined as a penalty, not as a tax. And the federal government does not have the ability to nitpick and decide we're going to tax this person and that person without having it be a direct tax or a per capita tax. So it is a because it is such a limited tax on such a limited number of individuals and not a blanket tax, is one of the things that calls into question the legitimacy of the tax in and of itself. So you're absolutely right. It is not a blanket tax. The more blanket tax would come in the form of the expanded Medicaid program. If indeed Wisconsin chooses to expand the Medicaid program, as the federal law had mandated that we do, that will be a tax upon pretty much all of our citizens, because we will have to contribute federally to more Medicaid payments and as a state to more Medicaid payments, as well as a state pay for the administration of that federal law.
Well, then we'll go to Brad in Eau Claire next. Hello, Brad.
Hello. We were awarded as a state $38 million in federal funds to set up health care exchanges, and myself, as well as a half a million other residents, would like to know why they turned that money down when it's mandated that they set up these exchanges. I mean, why are we waiting when the money was available months ago and we could be like a pioneer establishing like a model for other states to base their health care exchanges off of?
So the federal government offered money to set up these health exchanges and Wisconsin turned it down, Attorney General?
Yeah, and I'm not familiar with all of the details of that, because that's not something that has to do with the health care law necessarily, or the constitutionality of it, or what I do. That question or that comment, of course, relates more to policy decisions made by the governor and his administration, and what their decision-making criteria were is something that I'm not certain about on that specific issue. So why they turned that back is something that I can't answer for them. You know, I suspect it may have something to do with the fact that Wisconsin would probably have to contribute considerable monies in addition to that as well. You know, if somebody gives you $10 to buy something that costs $20, you still need to have the other $10. And of course, we've been in tight fiscal times, but I don't know the facts or the policy decision that went into that by the governor's office.
Do you know, though, the ruling does... The law says that if the state of Wisconsin does not set up a health insurance exchange, that the federal government will come in and do that for us. Is that right?
That is correct. The law states that we have a certain amount of time to set up the health care exchanges, within which time we may do that, or if we choose not to do that by that time frame, the federal government will do it for us. We certainly have time beyond the November elections to make sure that that is implemented.
Yeah. Does the state of Wisconsin get any sort of penalty if we don't do this?
You know, once again, we're getting a little into the weeds of the law itself, but I don't think so. If we do, I have not heard about it. The penalty essentially is you lose control to set up your own health care exchanges, and you're at the mercy of somebody else who's doing it for you, which I don't think anybody really wants.
We have an email from a listener in Janesville who asks, how is requiring health insurance different from requiring auto insurance? Why is one considered an example of the government controlling our lives and the other not?
Yeah, I like that example because it's been asked a lot, and it points out two very important parts of why this this aspect is unconstitutional from a Commerce Clause or regulation perspective. Obviously, requiring somebody to buy automobile insurance is a regulation and not a tax. Because if you don't do it, you know, you obviously don't pay unless you drive. So the big difference is the condition precedent. You don't need automobile insurance if you're not going to drive. So you have a choice in there. You do something, it's therefore regulated, versus healthcare. If you breathe, you have to buy it. If you live, you have to buy it. And that's really not a choice. I don't think people are going to end their lives to eliminate the need to buy health insurance. So there's a very big difference there. The other thing is automobile insurance is a state regulation and not a federal regulation. We weren't arguing that these types of things can't necessarily be regulated, but that the federal government does not have the power under the Constitution to so do. States have all the power that was not given to the federal government under the Constitution. So states can regulate things that the federal government cannot.
Well, so as we wrap things up here, are there any further legal avenues available on health care reform, or is this over?
Oh, it's in the political realm now. The reality is when I joined this suit, I made it very clear to anybody who would listen that we weren't suing over health care. We were suing over a constitutional expansion of the federal government's powers. And on both of the issues where we said the federal government was overreaching, we won. It was a great legal victory, as I had said in the press release after the decision had come out. The healthcare decision also won. It was allowed to remain standing, but that was not the legal issue that we were suing over. That's a policy decision left for the elected policy-making politicians, such as legislators, Congress, the Senate, President. If people do not like the health care law and they don't like the fact that it's been found to be a constitutional tax, then they need to do something about that at the polls. If they do like it, they support that at the polls. And that's where the decisions on this issue are going to be made in the future.
Thank you very much for being with us.
You bet. Thank you, Joy.
J.B. Van Hollen, Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin. Thanks to Bill Martins, who produced this hour. Thanks to Amanda Magnus, our on-air director, and Anaya Mukherjee, our on-air producer. And thank you for listening and for calling in. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. Coming up, it's another edition of On Your Money After 8. Certified financial planner Kevin McKinley will be here with some great money-saving advice and answers to your personal finance questions. That's coming up after 8 o'clock. And by the way, we will be here tomorrow on your holiday, on the 4th of July, Independence Day. We will be here with a live call-in talk from 6 in the morning until after 9. I know that we are planning on talking about 4th of July barbecuing and cooking out and our 4th of July picnics and parties and the food we will be eating coming up tomorrow morning between 6 and 7. So I hope you will join us for that. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.